Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. We have a wonderful guest today who's come back after he's been on the Solari Report several times. We're going to link to all of those wonderful interviews that are as timeless as ever. This is Dr. Edwin Vieira, who is one of the eminent constitutional attorneys in the country. And he is my go-to person. Whenever I have a question on the Constitution, whenever there's a debate, I consider him to be the, you know, the gold standard. And among other things, he has a history of monetary laws of the United States, Pieces of Eight, which is really, no library is complete without it, in my opinion. So Dr. Vieira, I've been trying to get you on for over a year and a half, and you've taken time out of what is a very packed schedule to do this, and I really very much appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Catherine. I want to forgive me for being in this attire, but I'm an ambulatory patient from a hospital visit I had yesterday. So I'm just kind of stuck with the situation that the doctors gave me.
Well, you look comfortable, so that's good. So I wanted to talk to you about a variety of constitutional issues that are happening in the country. So we see enormous debate and litigation on the First Amendment, enormous debate and action on the Second Amendment, continuing push that you and I have talked about. We have a whole Solari Report on it, on the madness of a constitutional convention. But across the board, there are multiple assaults on the Constitution. And I would love to know, you know, we also see extraordinary pushback using the Constitution. So I would really like to start with your assessment of the, you know, the state of the state in the Constitution and what you think are the most important constitutional debates and litigation going on today.
Well, what we see is a natural outgrowth, I think, of the development of a political movement in this country, which I would call basically neo-Bolshevist. They want a single political party running the country according to whatever its political and economic whims, social, cultural whims may be. And of course, the difficulty is that the Constitution stands in the way of that. You have the First Amendment, you have the Second Amendment, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, can go on, 14th Amendment when you're dealing with the states. And so we see essentially attacks on these, not directly in the sense that, except for the Second Amendment, I guess there are some people in the country who are suggesting that that should be in some way repealed or altered by a subsequent amendment. But what I would call practical attacks, such as the whole concept of hate speech, which of course is not an asterisk that's attached to the First Amendment that limits it, but terms of that nature so as to put constraints on people's ability to speak in a public forum, or another aspect of the First Amendment, to petition the government for redress of grievances, or, which is another aspect of the First Amendment, associational activities among various groups. That's number one. And then, of course, the Second Amendment they've been after for a long time because, as the founders understood, that was the ultimate bedrock of the entire system of popular control of government, that ultimately the people themselves had to have the ability to use armed force in what the Constitution describes in the Second Amendment as the militia, to be able to control a government that has gone beyond the realm of legitimacy as the Declaration of Independence describes it. So it's not surprising that these two go hand in hand. And then, of course, they're being applied in what I would consider to be a rather radical way to the various Trump indictments of Donald Trump that are going on with respect to what they're claiming is, say, in the Georgia case, election interference, where Trump or people associated with him were questioning the legitimacy, the propriety, whatever kind of word you want to use, of certain elections in certain states with respect to the selection of electors for the president in 2020. And it would seem, I mean, historically, that's never been challenged, that people would have a right to question the validity of elections. It's been done in this country since, I would guess, the very beginning in one sense. But now that has been raised by one side of the political spectrum into a tool, a method for suppressing speech by the other side. And I think that's an extremely dangerous situation because One of the foundational elements of our system, of course, is democratic representation. That's the Republican form of government. The people are represented, not they don't act directly in the sense of Athenian democracy. They act through representatives, and the representatives are, of course, chosen by the people through some form of electoral process. So if one side in that process can prevent the other side in that process from challenging the legitimacy of election when it is conceivable that it's one side that is actually interfering in that election, then we have a complete destruction of the whole system of representative government. The concept of representation goes out the window, and we have something that looks more like a Stalinist type of government, East German, Hungarian, Bulgarian, Romanian, whatever, during the Stalin era. So it's extraordinarily dangerous, and I think it's extraordinarily dangerous to the second degree because it's not just a few radical political activists who are promoting this. You see it in students coming out of the colleges or within the colleges. You see it in the mass media, at least the major mass media. You see it in the political party, specifically the Democratic Party. It has, in a sense, taken hold of the intellectual or the ability of people intellectually to look at our political system. And amazingly enough, simply throw out the First Amendment entirely. What's the famous quotation? I think it's Voltaire who says, I may disagree with your position, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. That's always been quoted in one version or another as the essence of the First Amendment. Whether a listener finds speech offensive or whatever, contrary to his views or whatever would be the standards he's applying, is not the test of the First Amendment. The test of the First Amendment is always, does this advance public debate, intelligent discourse? We've got all sorts of phrases come out of the Supreme Court opinions, and the First Amendment has nothing to do with the acceptability of a particular point of view. In fact, quite the opposite is true. The Supreme Court will say over and over again, has said over and over again, that it's precisely those opinions, attitudes, statements that most people find unacceptable that the First Amendment is directed to protect. And that's what we're trying to, I won't say necessarily promote, but at least give an opportunity to present. And that's what's stopping here. And of course, if you stop that, especially with respect to representative government, the mechanism of representative government, then you're on a one-way trajectory towards some sort of totalitarian system.
So I have not looked at the Trump indictments. On what basis do they say his questioning of the election is somehow illegal?
Well, I think they're trying to make out that what he was attempting to do was not simply question, but to cause actions to be taken that would result in improper steps in reversing the choice of the electors, sending a particular election back for further review of some kind or other. It's kind of a mishmash as to precisely what the theory is, because if we look back at the Bush-Gore election, where they had the terrific brouhaha debate over the voting in Florida, remember the hanging Chad concept, was the particular ballot instrument specifically sufficiently pushed through or whatever. That went on and on and on, eventually to the Supreme Court of the United States. And during the time that that was going on, there were some people who were saying, well, this was totally fictitious. These arguments are worthless. Well, maybe they were, because eventually the Supreme Court decided the election, or decided the result of the election, in favor of Bush, not of Gore. But the point was that those issues were ventilated at that time. Some prosecutor could not jump in. Of course, here they're jumping in essentially after the fact, but you can imagine them jumping in at the same time. Some prosecutor could not jump in and say, well, that criticism is going to be disallowed. Or if you make that kind of criticism, even though you may be wrong on the facts, you're going to be prosecuted afterwards. And give an example of this. There was in the Bush-Biden, the Trump-Biden election, I don't believe that there was a single court, including the Supreme Court of the United States, that ever took one of the contested elections and carried an investigation all the way through a trial setting with the presentation of evidence of one kind or another, and a trier of fact actually determining what the facts were, and therefore who would win or who would lose. But even if you assume that that had happened, what we know as litigator, I think all lawyers know, courts are not infallible. Courts reverse themselves all the time. And the mere fact that some court may have found in favor of, let's say, the Biden ticket instead of the Trump ticket, doesn't necessarily mean, number one, that the Trump litigators were wrong, and certainly, number two, that they were presenting some kind of illegitimate case to engage in some sort of nefarious action. If that had ever been the case, there is a procedure within the judicial system, certainly at the federal level, I imagine at every state court, which deals with what are called spurious or fictitious arguments. If a lawyer presents an argument that is not based in facts, at least facts that can be established with some kind of testimony, or is specious in terms of the law, then the court can impose a fine on that attorney or that attorney's client. So it's all right, done within the context of litigation, as opposed to something happening later on that's second or third guessing what's been done in that particular court case. And one thing lawyers know, lawyers make, what shall I say, sometimes imaginative arguments, pushing the envelope for their clients. The reason being that the law is not, cast in concrete. It has a certain level of flexibility and mutability to it. And I give you, in my mind, the classic example of this. There are two of them. One is a general example. Supreme Court case Payne versus Tennessee. I think it's in volume 500 of the Supreme Court reports. The very first footnote in that case lists all of the cases at that time in which the Supreme Court had reversed itself, which meant that in the subsequent case, some lawyer had to come forward and say, "Justices, you were wrong in that initial case, and we want you to recognize the fact that you were wrong and to reverse that decision." Classic example in my own case, I had one case 41 years later, after I lost that case in the Supreme Court reversed itself on the basis of the very arguments that I had made in the first case. So, could I have been prosecuted in that first case?
Let me step back. Let me step back and just act as a simple layperson. If serious citizens have a distrust in election. Elections are funded by the taxpayers for the benefit of the taxpayers. Shouldn't anyone have a right to demand proof that the election was run properly?
Well, that's where you have the what's called the standing problem. The courts have played games with this concept of standing. Standing is the interest that a person has in a particular situation. And if you don't have a sufficient interest in that situation, the court will say you don't have standing to bring the litigation. So one would say, well, yes, every voter certainly has an equal interest in the outcome of the election in which he or she voted. But the courts have this doctrine that, well, if the harm is generalized, if everyone in the community of interest is equally harmed, then no one has standing. Supreme Court just came up with this in a case called Massachusetts versus Mellon way back in the 1930s.
Well, it would seem to me that the president of the United States should have standing.
Well, let's see how far this reluctance of the courts to deal with this goes. You take the case of Texas versus Pennsylvania, which was the case that Texas brought in the original jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, challenging the electoral count in Pennsylvania, Georgia, several other states. The Supreme Court says, well, number one, we're not going to hear this in our original jurisdiction. We're going to exercise discretion not to hear it. I don't see how they have discretion not to hear a case in his original jurisdiction where the original jurisdiction is specifically given in the Constitution. And there are legitimate parties before the court, a group of states, Texas on the one hand, Pennsylvania on the other. Secondly, what was Texas challenging? It was challenging the vote in the Electoral College. The Electoral College is a state-based institution. The states choose the electors who go to the Electoral College. So any state would have clear standing to challenge a slate of electors from some other state.
So We've talked about the First and Second Amendment, and we've talked about elections. But before we go on, I wanted to just jump back to the Second Amendment, because there's been a tremendous effort to override or stop the Second Amendment. There are multiple assaults that have been happening, and the Second Amendment seems, in some sense, to get stronger every day. And I think I see much more popular support for the Second Amendment than I've ever seen in my lifetime. But part of the effort to chip away at the Second Amendment is something called red flag laws. How significant do you think the effort to chip away at the Second Amendment has been through red flag laws or any other strategies you know of?
Well, the effort is ongoing because, as I said earlier, the people who want to see this country move in a what I would call a totalitarian direction can't live with the Second Amendment in principle, because the Second Amendment really reflects the concept that the people themselves are in control of the government, right, as opposed to some elite group self-selected by a political party or otherwise. So there has been an ongoing attempt to chip away. And this goes way back. I mean, we're talking going back even to the 1930s and a little bit before that. National Firearms Act, which was passed in the 1930s, is a good example of it during the Roosevelt administration. It's become much more prevalent today because the antagonists of the Second Amendment are building upon or using crime with firearms, especially in large cities, as what I would say a propaganda excuse for limiting the right of innocent citizens to possess firearms and use them for self-defense purposes. And of course, there's been a tremendous backlash coming to the side, because people who are exposed to increasing levels of criminality are asking the question, why aren't I entitled to defend myself with a firearm in the same way some celebrity is or politician is who can afford to have security personnel? And on we go. So this process is one that's rather dynamic. And I think it's a manifestation of the real ultimate danger here, that the goal of the people on, you call them the left, I'm not so sure left is really the word, the totalitarian mentality, people with a totalitarian mentality, is to put the average citizen in a position where he cannot defend himself, whether it's from a totalitarian government or from criminal elements a totalitarian government is willing to tolerate for the purpose, really, of terrorizing the population.
Right.
The Bolsheviks were very good at using criminals to advance their agenda before Right. They became totally in power.
Right.
Now, red flag laws are just one of the manifestations of this, and it depends what you mean by a red flag law. If you're talking about someone who could be legitimately brought into a court and the court rule this person has to be put under psychiatric observation, so you had complete due process, we know who the instigator of this is, whether it's a public official, family member, whoever, we know the defendant, we know what the defendant's supposedly aberrant behavior is, we're going to have some psychiatric evaluation by experts in front of the court, and after all that's done, the court decides whether this person should be put under psychiatric care or otherwise restrained. There are statutes like that, I would believe, in every state in the country already. So we don't really need red flag laws for that purpose. The red flag laws have been designed to water down the amount of due process that's involved in removing a firearm from someone's possession. You really don't even have to determine that this individual, generally speaking, is a real danger to himself or to others to the extent that he would need psychiatric evaluation. If someone makes this claim, and then a judge is going to decide pretty much on the seat of his pants whether those firearms are going to be taken or not. So I think they're really setting up a kind of test situation. How far can we go from removing the red flag law standard from what we already have in terms of psychiatric evaluation required by some procedure that's already built into the law? And eventually they get to the point somewhere down the line where it's your political views are sufficient to disarm you, or your associations are political to disarm you, even though those political views, associations, speech, and so forth and so on, are not themselves criminal, or the manifestation of some kind of civil violation, or the manifestation of some kind of mental illness. They're trying as much as possible to generate theories on which people can be disarmed, period.
Right.
Because they're not ready to go yet, as far as this governor in New Mexico has just gone, of simply saying by executive order, executive UKs, as I would say, if you use the Russian term, that people cannot possess firearms in public for what would she call 30-day period, what she called the cooling off period. And you look at that and you say, number one, well, who is she cooling off? She's certainly not cooling off the criminal element. The criminal element doesn't care about this executive order one way or the other. And no one is saying that the average legitimate gun owner, a person possessing a firearm, needs to be cooled off. That person is doing nothing at all. And then she comes out and saying, well, even her own oath of office is not absolute. That's the way she put it. My oath of office is not absolute. Well, what is that but a statement that she can decide when she can step outside of the terms and conditions of her own authority in order to do what she personally wants to do?
Right.
Well, interestingly enough, her attorney general turned against it. The local sheriff turned against it. There have been lawsuits. It's already a temporary restraining. It's obviously beyond acceptability. However, that connection is the one that interests me, the connection between firearms possession or, let's say, misuse of firearms and public health, because we have in the country a very large number of people who I would say are, to a certain extent, brainwashed by public health anxiety.
Right.
And it's natural. Everyone's worried about his own health, right? And dangers to the health. So if you can connect this element A, to public health, there's a plausibility in some sort of executive decree based upon public health regulating A, because people only look at the public health aspects of this. You look at this New Mexico determination and you say, well, what is the connection between public health and the fact that there are criminals misusing firearms? And the answer is, well, rationally, there's none.
Right.
Obviously, someone is endangered or hurt by the criminal use of firearms, but it's not a public health issue. Nonetheless, this governor was willing to try to equate or at least integrate the two of them.
Well,
another
what's interesting
example
is
how
we,
far they're attempting yeah, people on that side attempting to go.
We just saw a new announcement by somebody who looked at the FBI data and realized the extraordinary number of gun shootings which are stopped by honest citizens carrying guns. The statistics are quite extraordinary. If
those are the ones that they know of.
Right, exactly.
Right? You have many,
very good point.
Yeah, you have many instances where the mere showing of the firearm is sufficient to cause the criminal to back off and say, I don't want to continue with this operation.
Right.
And guesstimates, right, show that those incidents have an even higher rate than the incidents that are actually reported.
Right.
And it's interesting because anyone who teaches gun law will tell someone, if you're engaged in that situation, you brandish a firearm, you show the firearm to dissuade the criminal from attacking you, you should immediately call 911. Because what the criminals do these days is they call 911 and they say, I was just assaulted by someone with a firearm. And then you become the target of the police investigation.
Right.
Apparently that hasn't quite caught on yet. But I imagine if the police were inundated with these calls, you'd see that statistic would go off the charts.
Right.
And that's what people, it's interesting, that's what people are most worried about in the Second Amendment context is personal protection. They're not worried so much about hunting. They're not worried so much about target shooting, all of those elements, personal protection. I come at it from a different perspective, that the Second Amendment is there to guarantee the efficacy of the state militias.
Right.
And there I'm talking about governmental entities. You'll find them in actual statutes. They're not groups of people on their own going off in the woods.
We did an excellent
and practicing with firearms.
We did an excellent Solari report with you on the militias, and I'm going to link to it. So we did one on militias.
Right. We're talking about different things here.
Right.
But even in that limited area of self-defense, you have large organizations, National Rifle Association, and various others that are actively promoting the concept of Second Amendment rights for the purpose of personal protection. And that's a key to it. If you didn't have those organizations out there, which actually I think they began really to become effective in the late 1960s after the 1968 Gun Control Act became law. People in the NRA at least began recognizing, wait a minute, these kinds of statutes are aimed inevitably at restricting or eliminating the right to keep and bear arms for the purposes the NRA was concerned with. So we have a lot of organization there. if we get to the people who are dealing with, as we said before, questions of First Amendment limitation, what are the organizations, the large-scale organizations there that are dealing with what the internet platforms are doing in relationship to the government, what the mass media are doing, what the government itself is doing? We're beginning to see some court cases coming out challenging the nefarious interactions of the government with the internet platforms. That's good, saying that the government cannot interfere in the exercise of free speech, even on private methods of communication. I think that's very important. But we're going to have to see more development there. Because, of course, the interesting thing on the First Amendment side is the other side, the proto-totalitarian side, has the greatest amount of influence in the mass media, in the internet platforms, in all of those things that tend to shape public opinion on that particular issue. They also have a lot of influence in the Second Amendment area. But as I said, there are these organizations that are spending huge amounts of money contesting them. And we haven't, at least I'm not aware of something like the ACLU coming out and attacking what was exposed by Tybee and some of these other people in terms of the attempts by the FBI to suppress the Hunter laptop story when that first appeared.
So
where was the ACLU on that issue?
I think you know. So let me turn to a new topic, and that is I spend a fair amount of time each year in Europe, and it's remarkable to see the difference of what's happening in the United States as a result of the Constitution versus Europe. Europe doesn't have the same structure. In particular, in the United States, the powers not delegated to the federal government are reserved to the states. In one sense, the states are superior to the federal government. And that gives state and local legislators a platform to stand on legally that you don't have in the other G7 nations that I know of. And we see all across the country extraordinary numbers of state legislators now moving to protect governmental sovereignty and individual sovereignty against the federal government. And one of the things I was curious as I watch and talk to these legislators, what do you think the states can do that would be the most effective in affirming and protecting the Constitution and their citizens under the Constitution?
Well, two things. First, in the Second Amendment area, and we can get that aside because I think that's pretty simple. Every state that I know of has a state militia structure. Most of them are moribund. They call them the unorganized militia or the reserve militia or whatever. And pretty much they're there on call of the governor, but otherwise most people don't even realize that they're members of these things. Those should be revitalized, and they should take over a great deal of the police authority within the states in particular, because that will bring a very large number of people to the recognition that they are directly part of the governmental apparatus. They're not sitting outside every 2 years or 4 years to vote in an election, but they are actual participants in the system. They actually have probably the very highest level of legal authority, if you go back to the Declaration of Independence, and that their role is critical. But let's leave that aside, because that's going to take a lot of public education. The thing that I think is, I would like to see, and I think could be most likely, is for the states to develop their own alternative currency systems based on silver and gold. And that, in my mind, has more possibility to it because of the economic pressure that's increasing. People call inflation and so forth and so on, these terms, because of the natural breakdown of the Federal Reserve structure, irredeemable paper currency and so forth and so on, which we've discussed before. And that can be done at the state level because the states have the reserve power in Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution. It's written in reverse English. No state shall make anything but gold and silver coin to tender in payment of debts, which means that the states reserve the power to make gold and silver coin tender in payment of debts. So what would they do? I think Texas has taken one of the first steps. The state sets up a state depository.
Right.
That depository accepts gold and silver from whomever. It then enables the depositors to exchange that gold and silver with other members of the depository structure for the normal transactions of their lives. And so now, automatically, on the face of it, you have a gold and silver currency system protected by the state because it's being run through the state depository and the reserved constitutional power of the states under Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the U.S. Constitution. Now, if you think about it, practically speaking, this thing would be digital in the sense that it's probably going to run entirely through computers. Well, what does that mean? In this depository, you can say, well, we're going to have a unit, the Troy grain. That's a good unit. And we can divide that Troy grain as much as we want. The computer doesn't care how many zeros there are to the right of the decimal point. So that would mean that you could buy a loaf of bread with gold, or certainly with silver, which wasn't possible during the coin era. You had coins, only a few, and they were certain sizes, and that was it. And that then generated the need for so-called token coinage, the nickels, the pennies, and then, of course, for bank transactions, which could be written in so many cents, right? Now, for the first time in history, because of the technological advantages that we have, we can actually run a gold and silver system that will encompass every transaction that you could imagine. We don't need paper money. We don't need token coinage. We don't need bank accounts in fictitious dollar units. It can all be done where every transaction is the actual transfer of ownership, a piece of gold and a piece of silver from one person to another. It changes the system entirely. Now, of course, you can imagine that the banking cartel, the Federal Reserve people, the U.S. Treasury, a lot of global interests are going to be against this, because the last thing they want is to have gold and silver being used as actual money, as opposed to some kind of reserves hidden so far in the background that no one can ever get hands on them. So they'll stop. They would try to stop it. But the beauty of the federal system, as you were referring to earlier, is that the Constitution specifically reserves the powers of the states to do this. Right. And what does that mean? It means that Congress has no authority to interfere, right? Mm-hmm. The reserve power of the state is an actual power of Congress. So the states can simply look at the Federal Reserve as it's collapsing and say, well, we don't want to deal with you anymore. And we don't want to deal with this new global digital currency, wherever that's coming from. There's one central bank or some consortium of central banks or whatever. We are going to set up our own depository structure. That's easy enough. We are going to allow anyone to bring gold and silver into our depository. And then we're going to run on internet accounting system these transactions. Well, Texas already has a depository system set up. Anyone can go to the Texas code and look up Texas State Depository and see how that runs. They haven't gone as far as I am proposing. But what I have done, I've sent a petition to the governor of Virginia saying this is what we should do in Virginia. We should take the next step, set up a Virginia depository with these elements attached. And then you go directly to, of course, all the businesses that are being regulated by the government, sales tax, income tax, various kind of corporate fees, whatever. And they come right into that system. Why? We require them to come into that system. The state already has them, right? The state is already imposing these financial requirements on businesses within the state.
But why not allow them to pay in gold and silver, but not require them to pay in gold and silver?
Excuse me?
Why not allow them to pay in gold and silver, but not require them to pay in gold and silver? Many of them don't have gold and silver. They have dollars. So if you require them to pay in gold and silver,
that's how we essentially prime the pump. If you say to a corporation, you're going to have to pay for a corporate fee in gold or silver, what do they have to do? They have to go into the marketplace and they have to acquire some gold and silver. Right.
But to acquire that, they have to pay quite a big premium.
Use as much.
Well, but they have to pay quite a big premium.
Well,
I mean, if you're not set up,
you're not going to change the system without cost being involved.
Right. But if you say they can and you set up the train tracks to do it on a voluntary basis, a lot of people will start to do it. And that's how you get the pump primed. if you mandate it, you're going to create massive dislocation, a lot of pushback that you don't need while you're working at the system. It's easier to start with a soft launch where you do voluntary and let the system and the infrastructure develop and get set up. And then if you want to go to mandatory, you can. But to do it overnight would be be too much friction in the system.
Well, I agree with that. We had a plan much earlier. We ran attempting to get some legislation reviewed in New Hampshire and then in Minnesota, where the pump priming was coming from the tobacco tax people. And the state would set up a depository and it would require the tobacco tax people to pay their tax in gold. We simplified it. And I'm not so sure that was a real burden on them, because you changed the amount, right? Instead of $500, so much gold, which was the equivalent of $500. So they really weren't being asked to pay any more. And then on the other end of that transaction, other end of that system, the state would offer to its creditors the option to have their payment in gold.
Right.
And the thought was, what happened here? All the creditors will come, or enough creditors will come very quickly to deplete this system. And then the treasurer would come back to the legislature and say, all of the tobacco tax money has been paid in gold. It's all been depleted within 3 months to our legitimate creditors. We want to increase the tax base. And they would pick this or that, which would be the next step to put in. But there are different experimental methods to get this thing going.
Right.
But the first thing is to have the depository set up with the ability to make the transactions.
Yes.
I mean, it's possible that you get the depository set up with the ability to make the transactions. Initially, no one makes the transactions. But unless the mechanism is there, there's never going to be any change.
Yeah, so I'm confident
of banks are never going to help you with this.
So I'm confident if you set up the mechanism, the market will be there. I do think one of the most important things is to set up mechanisms.
People use it.
Yeah, so I think the most important is to set up a mechanism where no one outside the state can interfere or stop financial transactions from occurring within the state. So that literally you don't allow the Fed payment system to shut down the ability of the citizens and the banks and the state to transact with each other within the state. So you want to avoid the Canadian trucker problem within the state induced by political forces outside the state.
Right. And that's the key to the Federalist aspect of this, that the states can do this under their reserved constitutional power, not just in their state constitution, leave that aside,
right,
but in the
right.
federal constitution. Which
right.
means that Congress and the executive branch have just no authority to interfere with this. So
right.
it tells the people in that particular state, now we're going to use the concept of reserve powers, the 10th Amendment concept. We actually have the authority to do some things for ourselves.
Right.
Look how important this is. And you compare this to what now. There's nothing that stops two people from making a private contract payable in gold or silver.
Right.
The question then becomes, well, how is that contract going to be valued and for tax purposes? Is it possible that the federal government could leap into this at some point in the future? Talk about long-term contracts especially. Could leap into this with something along the line of what Roosevelt did in 33, the gold seizure, the abrogation of gold clause contracts. And I think the answer is, well, no, not now, because in the 30s, the states never challenged their right to continue to use gold and silver for themselves and for their own citizens.
Right.
That was never one of the cases of the Supreme Court. That whole issue just kind of floated away. Right? So we're looking at a kind of virgin field here.
So
the interesting thing about the Texas business, the interesting thing about the Texas depository is, with a little bit of tweaking of their system, we could have it running in Texas, or they could have it running in
Texas.
Yes,
I agree. So let me bring up the last topic I wanted to cover. You and I did a wonderful interview where you explained why a constitutional convention was complete and utter madness. And I'm going to link to that interview as well. There has been a continual effort to try and get the states to vote for a constitutional convention, and it keeps getting beaten back. They don't have the votes yet, but I dare say you probably think it's, you know, as bad an idea now as it was when we did that interview. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think it's a worse idea now, because when it started, the purpose was limited to the a balanced amendment, right? That was catalyst. That's what we need. If we can have a balanced budget amendment, a lot of these other problems will be solved. And then people kept adding different amendments on this and that and so forth and so on. And I think now with the level of, internal dispute in this country, the real conflict over what the Constitution means, does it mean this, does it mean that, how it's going to be applied, how it's going to be applied there, you would have a plethora of proposed constitutional amendments coming forward from both sides of the aisle, as it were. Instead of one that you could look at very carefully, you're going to have a dozen, two dozen, whatever, and they will be bundled in some way, right? If we're going to take this one, we have to take these three or whatever else it is.
Oh, but I think once they open it up, it's open field running. They'll drive a truck through it with stuff you haven't even seen beforehand.
Oh, well, that's right. That's exactly the point. Right. There's no limit to what they can put in. There's no limit to the way they can bundle them. I may want this one, but they're going to tell me you have to have these other three for me to get this one. And these may be vaguely enough worded. So I say, well, maybe they're not so bad until they're passed and they get in front of Congress or they get in front of the courts and we discover what they really mean. You know what I mean?
Right. All right. No, Constitutional convention will rip up the Constitution, throw it out. That's what's going to happen.
Well, you know, let's just take the words "we." Let's say we strike everything after the word "we the people" and put a completely different text there. Right. Is that an amendment of the Constitution?
No.
It is. Right? Well, no, amendment. It's only going to be an amendment. No, we the people strike everything else and put in this new thing. The new state's constitution, Rex Wood Guy Tugwell from the 1930s, right? The technocrat's constitution.
Right.
So there's absolutely no limitation there. And the difficulty is now, the level of debate is, I hate to use this word, so moronic that almost anything could be put forward as somehow a legitimate constitutional amendment. Right?
Mm-hmm.
We could have something that looks like neo-Bolshevism presented as a legitimate constitutional amendment. The average person, that's legitimate to talk about. And people are becoming, I think this is another problem, people are becoming so desperate with the problems that we have, with the way the country is split by the cultural Marxist assault on it, that they are willing to take that chance. They're willing to roll the dice, get a constitutional convention of some kind in the hope limit the restriction that's being done to this country.
Well, but here's the problem.
And I think the opposite is going to happen.
We have all the laws we need. We don't enforce them. So if you don't enforce the good laws that you have, why do you pass more since you're not going to enforce them either? Right?
Well, that's right. Number one, Congress feels itself bound by the Constitution in terms of its legislative authority. The courts make up the laws as they go along. Many of the people at the beginning of this process said, well, this is our problem. Congress does whatever it wants to do. And when the case gets to the Supreme Court, they fudge it in one way or another. Well, anything that comes out of a constitutional convention or even something that comes out before, someone who has a challenge to some of the process that's being used in developing a constitutional convention, where will that go for resolution? That'll go to the same court system that they say is not doing its job now.
Okay,
this is our problem.
I said that was my last question, but I have one more question. From fiscal 1998 to 2015, the federal government refused to produce audited financial statements as required by law. And there's $21 trillion of undocumentable adjustments during that period. And they refused to say where that money went or how much it was. And then they stopped reporting the undocumentable adjustments after 2015. And then in 2018, they adopted an administrative policy called FASB 56, which takes the position as an administrative policy that they can take portions of the financial statements dark without telling you what went dark, who decided it, for what reason. And it can apply not just to the government, but to government contractors as well, who can also be freed from SEC disclosure requirements. So by fiat administrative policy, they took the position that they didn't have to obey the Constitution or the laws related to financial management as a matter of administrative policy agreed to by Congress and the executive branch together. Now, the question is there anybody on the planet who has standing to litigate that and demand that that be overturned?
Well, it would be interesting to see someone in the House of Representatives or Senate could claim to have standing to challenge these administrative agencies. Now, I think the courts would probably say, well, no, we're not going to decide this case. You people go and vote for some new statute that's the discretion of the agencies to do, overturns what they've done. You know, I think the problem that we have here is we have to get, a sea change. Catherine, is Congress is not controlling the situation.
Right.
Right. Everything that you suggested is going on is subject to congressional disapproval. Let's say that.
Right. Congress can stop the appropriations right away until they get proper financial disclosure. They have the power to stop it like this.
That's the Constitution, which says all appropriations have to be as a result of laws passed.
Right.
So there's absolutely no question that they can shut off the funding
right
at any point in time that they want. But I think you might want to go a little bit further and say, doing this kind of thing by hook or crook, any attempt that you do this is going to be penalized some other way. Because you know that if you or I and our accountants were to engage in this kind of shenanigans, we'd be subject to all sorts of penalties.
So let me close with just one more. I keep saying I only have one more question. I absolutely believe that the power of the Constitution is more than the law. I think the Constitution reflects a spiritual and cultural and philosophic covenant between Americans that mean a great deal to many, many Americans. And it's more than just a document or a framework for our legal structure and infrastructure. It really is a covenant that binds us as what it means to be an American. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes, but you go back one step to the Declaration of Independence, right? What was what I would call the statement of principles at the beginning of the Declaration is the natural law concept.
Right.
As a result of the laws of nature and nature. They weren't talking about gravity there. They were talking about natural law, which goes back in Western history all the way to ancient Rome, Greece, and so forth. Kind of the underpinning of everything that's going on in European civilization. And they say that is the basis on which governments have to act. The purpose of government is to guarantee those natural rights for the benefit of the citizens. And if the citizens see the government not acting that way, then they gain the right to alter or abolish the government and to reform that government in such a manner that it will actually perform its functions.
Right.
What we see happening in this country is the cultural Marxist undermining of all of that. There is no unified belief in a particular structure of rights, government, role of the people, the rights of the people. It's a constant mix of class conflicts. The original Marxist class conflict was the bourgeoisie versus the proletariat, right? The workers versus the owners of capital. And that was going to demolish bourgeois society and eventually lead us to the nirvana of communism. It didn't work out because Marx was not a very good economist, right? And one of the things that the so-called proletariat realized, they could labor legislation kinds of bits working through the political system, and didn't require revolution. So the cultural Marxists looked at that, we're never going to achieve our communistic goals going at it from the old Marxist capital versus labor conflict. We have to create as many conflicts in society as we can, men versus women, young versus old, one race, and one gender versus another gender, on and on we go to undermine the basic supports, philosophical and cultural supports of this society, at which point people will become so demoralized, so dejected, so confused that they will be willing to accept our proposal to correct the situation, which will be some kind of totalitarian state, which nobody is going to have these problems because they'll all be suppressed. Of course, we're not going to tell them that that's the result, but that is what we are aiming at. And so that's what we see right now. People, what the Constitution means, or even apparently in New Mexico, the code. They don't agree about the limits of government or the nature of government or the form of government. They don't agree to what basic rights individuals have in terms of freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of petition, freedom to own firearms, and on we go. Due process of law, right? On and on we go. All of this generated by the cultural Marxist movement. How do you overcome that? Well, ultimately, that's a cultural problem, isn't it? If they've destroyed right. the ability of people to think in terms of the historical cultures, and that's why they want to tear down monuments. That's why they want to change street names, and on we go. This whole cultural revolution, where was that? Maoist China, right? You right. change the culture, and then you rebuild something else on ruins. Well, right. that's an educational problem, ultimately. So where do we, in a sense, where does one go? Well, we have to go back to the basic educational system. I think people are waking up to that because the teacher unions, the professional educational establishment, some of these school boards and educational groups have begun to push too far and too fast. And the average person is looking at the situation, especially in the lower level of the public school, and saying, wait a minute, we've got gender ideology being taught. We've got this radical sexual education and anti-Americanism, left, right, center, as various mansions. We have to stop this in some way. And you see the reaction coming out of...
Well, part of it is they're charging higher and higher real estate taxes to fund all of this.
Well, that's right.
Right.
So I look at this as a very long-term process because the cultural Marxists have been at this since what? I would say since at least the 1930s.
Right.
And they've become increasingly effective, right? And they've taken over more of the most important parts of the cultural mechanism. And I give just one example of my own experience, teachers unions. Teachers unions have been radicalized since the 1960s, even before they obtained collective bargaining rights. And once they obtained collective bargaining rights, well, then all bets were off because now they had an ability to effectuate policy on both sides of the bargaining table. They'd bring their own representatives in on one side, and then they would elect or arrange to have the school boards. And so the members would now be one way or another politically beholden to the teachers' unions, and they'd make sweetheart arrangements of one kind or another. And people are beginning to look at this and say, oh, well, wait a minute, unions have too much power, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And the answer is very simple. Teacher collective bargaining in the public sector is not a constitutional right.
Right.
It can be removed tomorrow by a statute. We used to have a statute in Virginia that did that at every level. Collective bargaining was impermissible by statutory decree.
So let me ask you this. If you're listening to this, obviously it's different in different states. But what are the few things that everybody can consider doing to take this in the right direction?
Well, that's a very difficult one as to where you start to take it in the right direction.
So let me give you an example. Where we've started is we have turned to the state legislators who are working to protect sovereignty within their states and do things like bullion depositories. And we've offered briefing, education, and when they ask us to research things and publish things, we've offered research help. So what we've said to the state legislators who are moving to really act, what can we do to help and how can we provide you with support to make this go? So I find finding the people fighting for it, the state legislator, and supporting them to be a very useful thing to do.
Well, it's going to be in both the state legislature and the state executives, because executive offices, governors, sometimes have the ability to exercise certain kinds of power on their own through executive
right.
orders.
The attorney generals have been very instrumental as well.
Well, that's another possibility into litigation. But I'm thinking more along the lines of something that would be legislative or executive. In Virginia, as an example, the governors have the authority to set up gubernatorial advisory commissions who can look into whatever issue the governors consider is important to investigate. So what can one do? One can go to the governor and say, "Governor, I propose that you write an executive order creating a gubernatorial advisory commission to look into this issue of something connected with state sovereignty." In Virginia, you can also do that through the legislature. The legislature can set up legislative study commissions for that various purpose. I would go one step further. I would present those people with the result that I want them to come out with. Say, this is what will be done. I want you to submit this to an advisory commission and have the advisory commission pass on this, maybe amend it, whatever. But this is an important thing to do. And I have done that, actually. It's out there now. The governor of Virginia dealing with the alternative currency question.
Right.
I said, we need to have an alternative currency. We need the state to start exerting its sovereign power in this area. I want you to set up a gubernatorial advisory commission to look into this. Oh, and by the way, here's a study that I have written on the issue to convince you that it's significant. And I think if that were to happen, here, for instance, here in Virginia, you might begin to see some legislative action.
Right.
Now, at the lowest level, the public education, I think what they're doing in challenging these school boards, the parents, in challenging these school boards in terms of what's being taught in the schools, what's being presented in the libraries, especially to children in the lower schools, is very important too, because it's a self-educational process. You go to one of these meetings and you have average parents talking about these issues. They have done a great deal of research. That's been my experience. They know what they're talking about. And ultimately, reform is going to come at local level, either by the parents forcing the school boards to change their policies, the parents pulling their students out of the public schools and putting them into some kind of private schooling or homeschooling. And thirdly, I think the most important one overall is to eliminate the power of the teachers' union legislation. Just pass it, they're gone.
Right.
Tomorrow, they're gone.
Right.
And no one ever talks about this. No one ever says, wait a minute, where do they get this authority? And the answer is, some state legislature created authority for compulsory collective bargaining.
Right.
It was never there before. The Supreme Court actually ruled in the late 1960s, early 1970s, because the unions were trying to make a claim that it was a right of theirs to bargain with public sector employers as a matter of freedom of petition. And the Supreme Court said, this isn't petition. You're demanding that they sit down and negotiate with different things entirely. That's a requirement to that. And then they turned quite naturally to the legislative process. And they rolled up Wisconsin, Minnesota, you think of some of these liberal states. Immediately started by 1964, they started passing legislation to enable collective bargaining to take hold.
Right.
And of course, the NEA was very instrumental in that because they had organization from the top down, from Washington, D.C. to the state level to the local level where the local schools were. AFT, American Federation of Teachers, same in the big cities. And subsequently, they have developed a stranglehold on public education. And as a result of that, partially a stranglehold on what I would call cultural appreciation the appreciation people have of what their culture is. Because where does this come from? It comes out of what people are taught in the schools.
Right.
Right? If they're listening to the project and that America and its constitution are fundamentally racist and based on slavery, and they're learning that through all the way to high school, how are they going to react when they're as voters outside and listening to arguments coming from people who are basing their policies on that predicate?
Right.
So we have a big educational problem to deal with.
You know, something, we have many problems to deal with. I have to interrupt you because we have approached and passed our time. It's very important to me that people know where to find your material, including getting a copy of Pieces of Eight or any of your other books and materials that are available. Could you just describe how we can find your materials and books?
Well, you can find a great deal that I've written on it site called News with Views, one word, newswithviews.com.
Uh-huh.
Very large archive of things I've written for 15, 20 years or whatever. Books of mine have been available on Amazon. Right now there's a hiatus because my book distributor went out of business and I'm trying to line up another one, but they'll be up again shortly on Amazon.
Okay.
And some of them are there, you know, as used books, but that's basically the only site that I ever use for the distribution of books. And they can find a great deal of what I've done in terms of presentation simply looking at the internet.
So Pieces of Eight is not available in CD or PDF?
Not available at the present time.
Okay. Okay.
Unless you buy used. But it will be shortly.
Okay.
I'm working on that right now.
Okay, well, I have to tell you, it's a masterpiece. I think, I told you, I don't think a library is complete in the United States without a copy of that book in it.
Well, when it was originally published, we sent copies to every federal court, state Supreme Court, and to a very
really?
Large number of public libraries. Oh, yeah.
What a magnificent
thing to do.
Oh, yeah,
there must be several hundred of them out there. Where people can access them directly.
Well, I just want to...
I sent all the courts because it's a legal book, basically.
Right. I just want to tell everybody that, put it on your bucket list or your Christmas list, Pieces of Eight, a complete monetary history of the United States. It's quite extraordinary. So anyway, so Dr. Vera, I can't thank you enough for everything you do. We're going to link up all your interviews to this interview. And it's an extraordinary body that, it's so funny because it's as timely today as it was when we recorded it. It's, it's kind of the nature of the Constitution and that the fact that the bad guys are always trying to tear it down and you and your colleagues are always trying to, you're at the barricade and you're always protecting us. So I'm very grateful.
Yeah, well, at a dangerous point now because they've been very active. They've been
right.
very effective in doing what they've been doing because
yep.
too many people who are constitutionalists in spirit are not constitutionalists in action.
Right. Right. Well, it's time to get off the couch. So Dr. Edwin Vieira, thank you for joining us on the Salieri Report. You have a wonderful day. If there's anything we can do to continue to support your work, you just let us know. We're huge fans.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.